minds of the CEOs. It was the fate of their own firms. What would Lehman's bankruptcy mean for them? Was Merrill really next? What about Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs? And what about J.P. Morgan or Citigroup? While commercial banks like J.P. Morgan had large, stable deposit bases, they still funded part of their business the same way the broker-dealers did, by regularly rolling over short-term commercial paper contracts that had become subject to the same erosion of confidence that had brought down Bear Stearns, and now Lehman Brothers. To them, the waning trust only suggested the nefarious handiwork of short sellers. At one point, John Mack questioned the whole idea of bailouts and ruminated aloud about whether they should just let Merrill fail too, even though seated just a few paces away from him was Peter Krause, who was standing in for John Thane. The question quickly quieted the room. Some thought he was gaming all of them. Maybe he wanted to buy Merrill on the cheap. What they didn't know was that he had approached Thane just hours earlier and had set a meeting for that evening. Diamond looked at Mac dumbfounded. "If we do that," he said caustically, "how many hours do you think it would be before Fidelity would call you up and tell you it was no longer willing to roll your paper?" When Thane finally did call Ken Lewis, the conversation was brief and to the point, merely a discussion of the logistics of their meeting. Thane was concerned enough to get the details correct that he called Lewis back a second time to confirm which entrance of the Time Warner Center he ought to use. Before driving over to Lewis's apartment, Thane met with Fleming at the firm's Midtown offices to strategize. He made it clear to Fleming that the discussions were purely exploratory, and that he wanted to sell only a small stake in the firm, maybe up to 20%. "He's not going to go for that," Fleming warned. "Lewis is going to say that he wants to buy the whole company." Thane opened the car door himself, making a beeline to the entrance. Ducking under the extended steel and glass awning with its One Central Park address, he rushed solo up the South Tower to Lewis's apartment. Lewis greeted Thane warmly in a room with striking views, but one that revealed its status as a corporate apartment by the virtual absence of artwork or furniture. "Given all the events that were going on," Thane said, once they settled themselves, "I am concerned about the impact on the market and on Merrill if Lehman were to go bankrupt." He paused for a few seconds and then said bluntly, "I'd like to explore whether you have an interest in buying a 9.9% stake in the company and providing a large liquidity facility." "Well, I'm not really very interested in buying 9.9% of the company," Lewis shot right back just as directly. "But I am interested in buying all the company." "I didn't come here to sell the entire company," Thane replied with a slight grin on his face, having not expected Lewis to be so aggressive. "That's what I'm interested in," Lewis repeated firmly. Thane nervously tried to forge a compromise. "Are you willing to go down two tracks? Explore a 9.9% sale and explore a 100% sale?" "Yes," Lewis agreed. "But remember that I said to you, I'm not really interested in 9.9%. I'm really interested in a full merger." Lewis and Thane spent the next half hour reviewing the various mix of businesses, the strategic rationale for a merger, and assembling some due diligence teams. Lewis suggested they reconvene with the two Gregs, Greg Curl and Greg Fleming, at 5 p.m. "I can't do it then," Thane told Lewis. Strange, Lewis thought. Thane showed up wanting to do a deal, and now he couldn't meet in 2 hours? Did he have somewhere better to be? Was he in talks with someone else? As he was about to leave, Thane stopped and raised a final point. "I have to tell Hank about these conversations," he explained, "because I'm worried that if Hank finds out about them, he's going to think that I screwed up the Lehman deal." "Well, look, you know," Lewis answered, "I would prefer the Merrill deal. You can tell Hank that we're having these discussions because we're not going to pursue Lehman without government assistance." In the end, the men would separately brief Paulson, who, as it happened, was thrilled to hear the news. As far as he was concerned, Barclays was about to buy Lehman, and now Bank of America was talking about acquiring Merrill. It was all coming together. "I got voicemail again. a frustrated Fold told Tom Russo. Nobody's picking up his goddamn phone. He could not locate anyone he needed. Paulson, Geithner, Cox, Lewis, even Bart McDade, his own employee, was unreachable. They were all down at the NY Fed, but no one was taking his call or calling him back. Fold wanted an update. He had been in his office all of Saturday, dressed in a blue suit and starched white shirt, as if it were a typical workday, but hadn't heard a word about Bank of America or Barclays. When the phone did ring, it was Rajan Cohen, who, calling from the NY Fed, said, "Yeah, we've got a problem. I think Merrill and B of A are talking." "What do you mean?" Fold barked. Cohen explained that he had just left a meeting with Geithner, at which he tried to persuade him again that government assistance was necessary to avoid the collapse of the entire banking system. As Cohen recounted it, he had told Geithner, "If you don't help, Merrill will be gone by Monday." Geithner's response, "We're working on a solution for Merrill," had been purposefully vague, but both Cohen and Fold knew exactly what it meant. It also explained Bank of America's silence. They both hadn't forgotten Greg Curl's comment to them over the summer about how Lewis had always wanted to buy Merrill, and it explained the odd phone call Cohen had received from Merrill's Fleming earlier in the week, casting about for information. "I can't even believe this," Fold said, sinking deeper into his chair. During some downtime at the NY Fed, Gary Cohn and David Vinier of Goldman Sachs greeted their former colleague, Peter Krause, who was now a week into his new job at Merrill. "Peter, come for a walk," Cohn suggested, and all three men stepped out the front door onto Liberty Street. "So, what's going on?" Cohn asked after they had gone a short way, hinting that he knew that Merrill was under enormous pressure, perhaps more so than anyone in the room. "We just have a liquidity problem," Krause said. "J.P. Morgan just upped our intraday margin lines by $10 billion. He paused. "We're fine. We're totally fine." "Peter, should we be looking at you guys?" Cohn asked. Krause looked down before answering, "Yes." Any deal with Goldman would not just shore up Merrill's teetering financial position, but also would be seen as a vote of confidence by the smartest guys in the room. "Why didn't you say something?" Cohn asked. "We've been friends forever. We've been sitting next to each other for a day and a half." As they strolled around the block, Krause said that it would be worth having a meeting. He said that Merrill would be looking for a credit line to get over the hump of their liquidity crisis in exchange for selling a small stake in the company, probably under 10%. It was nearly the same arrangement that Thane had originally been seeking from Lewis. They agreed to meet the following morning at Goldman Sachs' offices. The instructions were specific. Don't use the main entrance of the New York Federal Reserve on Liberty Street. Use instead the employee entrance on Maiden Lane, and show your driver's license to the security guards. Your name will be on a list. An escort will be waiting for you. Bob Willemstad of AIG and his advisors, Doug Bronstein of J.P. Morgan, Jamie Gamble of Simpson Thacker, and Michael Wiseman of Sullivan & Cromwell, walked over from AIG's headquarters to meet with Paulson and Geithner, strolling past the photographers and reporters who, to the banker's relief, didn't recognize them. "Where do you stand on the capital raise?" Geithner asked without preamble. Willemstad said that he believed that they were making progress. A half-dozen bidders were still at the building, including Flowers, KKR, and Alliance. But, Willemstad said, the bigger news, the good news, was that he had persuaded Eric R. Dinallo, superintendent of the New York State Insurance Department, to release some $20 billion in collateral from AIG's regulated insurance entities, which would help it meet its capital requirement. Dinallo had made the agreement contingent on AIG's raising another $20 billion to fill the hole. Willemstad intimated that he thought he had another $5 billion loan commitment coming from Ajit Jain, who ran Berkshire Hathaway's reinsurance business. That left him with a $15 billion gap, but he told the regulators that the company had assets up for sale that were worth more than $25 billion. With that, Paulson and Geithner rose and abruptly left the meeting. They had heard all they needed to. Progress was being made. The doorman opened the cast iron and glass doors to allow Thane, Kraus, and their colleague, Tom Montag, into the lobby of Walid Shamah's apartment building. It was the second secret merger meeting to take place there in 1 week. Thane was a little worried about being spotted. Among others, Larry Fink of BlackRock lived at the same address. Mac, Shamah, and Gorman were waiting for them in Shamah's living room. Gorman, who had run Merrill Lynch's private client business for 5 years before joining Morgan Stanley, was immediately struck by the fact that no one in the group representing Merrill had been with the company for more than 10 months. The firm Gorman helped to build, and where his brother Nick still worked, was going to be sold out from under it by bankers with no sense of the firm's heritage. Thane opened the discussion by indicating that he was looking to do a deal. "With what's going on with Lehman," he said, "we recognize this is the right time to look at our options." Kraus began to go over the numbers, flipping through the pages of a book he had brought along with him. For someone who had only a few days on the job, Shamah and Gorman thought, he seemed to know his stuff. Kraus had, in fact, stayed up till 3 a.m. earlier that week, poring over the firm's balance sheet. But the gaps in his knowledge soon became apparent. When Gorman started asking him about Merrill's retail business, the part of the company in which Morgan Stanley was most interested, neither Thane, Kraus, nor Montag knew the numbers. Still, Max said he was interested and asked what the next step was. "We have a board meeting scheduled for Monday night," he explained, "and Tuesday we could probably start diligence and take a look then. It's obviously intriguing, but this is complicated." Thane gave Kraus an anxious glance and then turned to Mac. No, you don't understand. We would need to have a decision before Asia opens." Gorman was confused. "What do you mean by decision?" "We're looking to have a signed deal by then," Thane said calmly. "We can keep talking," Mac answered, shocked by the request, "but I don't know that that's physically possible." After seeing themselves out of the apartment, Thane looked at Kraus and said, "Well, it's pretty clear that they don't have the same sense of urgency that we do." Greg Curl of Bank of America was already at Wachtell Lipton when Greg Fleming of Merrill Lynch arrived. While he waited, Curl had been on the telephone trying to undo his decision from 4 hours earlier. He had sent more than 100 bankers back to Charlotte, assuming they were no longer needed, because as far as he had been concerned, the Lehman deal was dead. Now, with the possibility of a deal with Merrill, he needed them on the next plane back to New York. He recognized that the situation was almost comical and had assigned several people to coordinate looking into chartering flights, because the three remaining direct U.S. Airways flights to New York that night were already full. Curl invited Fleming into one of the law firm's conference rooms that he had commandeered, grabbing a handful of cookies from the catering cart that was parked there. He quickly asked him for his assessment of where he thought they were in terms of pursuing a deal. "I'm thinking we announce Monday morning," Fleming said. "That's very quick," Curl replied, taken aback by the timetable. "You know the company really well," Fleming answered. He was one of the few people who were aware that Merrill's former CEO, Stanley O'Neill, had talked to Lewis about a merger, though he didn't know all the details. "I know all the work you've already done. I'll open up everything. Just tell me what you need." For the next half hour, they drew up a process that would enable Bank of America to examine Merrill's books within literally 24 hours. Curl, who dusted off the work he had done a year ago for the talks with O'Neill, said he was going to bring Chris Flowers in to advise him, as Flowers had recently looked into buying some of Merrill's toxic assets over the summer, assets that were ultimately sold to Lone Star National Bank. So he would have a head start. Bank of America already even had a code name for the deal, Project Alpha. Before the meeting broke, the issue of price was raised. Fleming boldly declared that he was looking for something with a 3 handle, by which he meant $30 a share or more, which represented a 76% premium over Merrill's share price of $17.05 on Friday. It was a shockingly high number, especially in the context of the greatest financial crisis of the firm's history. But Fleming felt he had no choice. Merrill had just sold $8.55 billion of convertible stock a month earlier to big investors, like Singapore's state-owned Temasek, at $22.50 a share. He needed to get them a reasonable premium. For most bankers, a number that high would have stopped the talks in their tracks. But Curl understood the rationale behind the price that Fleming was seeking. Fleming argued that Merrill's shares were temporarily depressed, and that he needed a price that reflected a normalized basis. Just a year and a half ago, he reminded him, Merrill's shares were trading at more than $80. Curl had a strong view about takeovers. You never want to overpay, but if you believe in the business, you're better off paying more to guarantee you own it than to lose it to a competitor. Okay, Curl said, not committing to Fleming's number, but clearly indicating that he wasn't going to reject it altogether. We've got a lot to do. The weather was beautiful for a late Saturday night dinner on the patio of San Pietro's, the southern Italian restaurant on East 54th Street, off Madison Avenue. During the weekday, the restaurant plays host to Wall Street bigwigs over lunch, Joseph Perella of Perella Weinberg, the dean of the M&A banking business, has a table there. Other regulars include Larry Fink, chief executive of BlackRock, Richard A. Grasso, the former chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, Ronald O. Perelman, the chairman of Revlon, and David H. Kamansky, the former chief executive of Merrill Lynch, and even former President Bill Clinton and his pal Vernon Jordan. Tonight, Mac and Morgan Stanley's management took a quiet table outside. For Chama, it was an opportunity to unwind and smoke a cigar. It had been a draining 24 hours. Gerardo Bruno, a big personality from southern Italy who owns the restaurant with his three brothers, showed the group to their table. Mac took his blazer off and threw it over the back of his chair. Soon, Paul Taubman, Colm Kelleher, and Gary Lynch met them there. There was a lot to talk about. After ordering a bottle of Barbaresco, they launched into a post-mortem of the grueling day, specifically the last crazy hour with Merrill Lynch, with Mac recounting the meeting with Thane for the benefit of those who hadn't been in the room with him. And then he says, "Can you do it in 24 hours?" Mac reported as the table erupted in laughter. "No fucking way," Colm Kelleher said. Once the laughter died down, Mac raised the biggest question before them. Given the scope of the crisis now enveloping the industry, did they need to do a deal? Chama spoke up first. "Listen, there are not too many dancing partners out there that we want to dance with. If there's ever going to be a time to talk, now's probably the time." Gorman stepped in and explained that Merrill Lynch, given their conversation just an hour ago with Thane, was likely to merge with Bank of America, perhaps within the next 24 hours. That meant that Bank of America would be taken off the table as a merger partner. Gorman was still shaking his head over the audacity of Thane, Krauss, and Montag's attempt to sell Merrill, a firm they had only recently joined and hardly knew. "We could call Lewis," Gorman suggested. Mac had always thought that Bank of America could be a natural merger partner for Morgan Stanley. Indeed, before the crisis, he had often half-joked with friends that it was his exit strategy. When his stock price was higher, he had often thought a deal with Bank of America would be one triumphant way of demonstrating that he had restored Morgan Stanley, the firm he loved, to its former glory. Strategically, they were a perfect fit. Bank of America was an outstanding commercial and retail bank, but its investment side was weak. Morgan Stanley had the opposite configuration. It was a superior investment bank, but had few stable deposits. Perhaps the best part of the merger would be that Mac, a native of Charlotte, where Bank of America was based, could retire there with his family as the new combined bank's chairman. But tonight, Mac understood, it wasn't meant to be. "If Merrill goes to B of A, what do you think about Wachovia?" he asked as plates of tibolo di bacala con patate, fave a pomodoro, arrived at the table. For the next 2 hours, they debated the merits of reaching out to Wachovia, also based in Charlotte, J.P. Morgan Chase, or HSBC. They could call China Investment Corporation, the nation's largest sovereign wealth fund, Kelleher suggested, while Paul Taubman mentioned Mitsubishi. Whomever they might select, Mac was adamant on one point. "We shouldn't be rushed into anything." While it might be ugly out there, he reminded everyone of the obvious. They were Morgan Stanley, the global financial juggernaut. The firm's market value was still more than $50 billion as of that Friday, a lot less than a month earlier, but hardly a joke. And they had $180 billion in the bank. Kelleher, the bank's CFO, had been diligently building up liquidity for months in the event of just such a situation in which they now found themselves. There was no way there could be a run on Morgan Stanley. They had too much credibility in the market. At the same time, he recognized that if Lehman was sold to Barclays and Merrill was sold to Bank of America, his firm would be in the hot seat. Chama, taking a sip of wine, said soberly, "We could be up next." It was after 8 p.m., and Jamie Dimon, who was starving, made his way up to the executive dining room on the 49th floor of J.P. Morgan's headquarters. The operating committee had been working flat out for the entire day, calculating the firm's exposure to Lehman, Merrill, Morgan Stanley, Goldman, and of course AIG. And the dining staff had been called in to work overtime to feed everyone. Tonight was tacos. And though the food may not have been as good as what the Fed offered downtown, it was better than Dimon had remembered. It was also the first time he'd eaten dinner in the recently renovated partner's dining room. In the middle of his meal, Dimon stood up and began pacing back and forth in front of the floor-to-ceiling windows, surveying the cityscape. From his vantage point, he could see all of Manhattan in every direction. The sun had just crested below the Empire State Building a half hour earlier, and a fog hung over the city. Dimon was mulling over the day's events, realizing how bad it was out there. "They want Wall Street to pay," he told the room of bankers relaxing after their late dinners, hoping to get them to appreciate the political pressure Paulson was facing. "They think we're overpaid assholes. There's no politician, no president, who is going to sign off on a bailout." Then, channeling the populist anger, he asked, "Why would you try to bail out people whose sole job it is to make money?" "We just hit the iceberg," Dimon bellowed to his men, as if he were standing upon the deck of the Titanic. "The boat is filling with water, and the music is still playing. There aren't enough lifeboats," he said with a wry smile. "Someone is going to die. So you might as well enjoy the champagne and caviar." With that, he returned to his table and took a final bite of taco. At the Fed, Barclays, against all odds, appeared to be making progress. Earlier that day, Michael Klein, Dimon's advisor, had come up with a structure for the deal with which they were all happy. Dimon wasn't interested in Lehman's real estate assets. What he wanted was the good bank, Lehman minus its troubled property holdings. Klein's plan was simple. Barclays would buy good Lehman, and the rival banks across the hall at the Fed would help finance the bad bank's debt. That struck Dimon as a clean deal he could easily sell to his board back in London, and to the British regulators, who he knew were still a bit skittish about the transaction. All in, it would cost $3.5 billion, which would be used to help support the bad bank. Past midnight, the Barclays team decamped from their conference room, planning to leave. But as they marched downstairs, they were pulled aside into another conference room and asked to explain their plan to the rival bankers, who were still at the Fed. This would be a tricky maneuver. They were, in effect, being asked to sell their bitterest rivals in the industry to subsidize their bid. Despite the hour, a group of bankers from Goldman, Citi, Credit Suisse, and other firms were still lingering about. Klein proceeded to explain, in the most delicate way possible, Barclays' plan, which everyone in the room instantly realized meant that an industry consortium would have to come up with some $33 billion to finance Shitco, or, as Klein kept describing it to people, Remainder Co. For the other banks, this would be less an investment in Lehman or Barclays than it would be in themselves, hoping to stave off the impact of a Lehman failure. The way Klein explained it, the consortium would own the equivalent of an alternative investment management firm like Fortress Investment or Blackstone Group, owning Lehman's real estate and private equity assets. The idea was not received with enthusiasm. Gary Shedlin of Citigroup, a former colleague of Klein's, was the first to raise red flags, perhaps because an undercurrent of tension still existed between him and Klein, stemming from clashes during their time together at Citi. "How much equity do you need to raise to do the deal?" Shedlin asked. Why is that important? Klein responded, seemingly confused about its relevance. Why do you need to know that? You're making an offer for this company, Shedlin snapped back, and we've got to know how you're going to finance it. Archie Cox of Barclays, frustrated by the questioning, replied icily, We will not have to raise any incremental capital as part of this transaction. Klein, realizing that the bankers didn't understand the structure of the deal, explained it again. Barclays wasn't going to be investing in Lehman's bad bank alongside the consortium. It was only buying Lehman's good bank. The bankers around the table looked at each other as his explanations set in. They really were being asked to subsidize a competitor. Barclays would have no stake in Lehman's worst assets, which they were being asked to take on. After Shedlin calmed down, the group, while not happy about the proposal, agreed that it might be the best of many bad options. They set about hammering out a term sheet. As unbelievable as it seemed to all the bleary-eyed bankers in the room, they were inching toward a possible deal. We've got a big problem. I mean fucking big, Douglas Braunstein of J.P. Morgan announced to his team at AIG just past midnight. The lights were still ablaze where a battalion of bankers, hunched over laptops and spreadsheets, had just discovered a new hole in AIG's finances. Its securities lending business had lost $20 billion more than anyone had recorded. We're not trying to solve for $40 billion anymore, Braunstein shouted. We need $60 billion. AIG was such a sprawling mess, and its computer systems so bizarrely antiquated, that no one conducting diligence had until that moment discovered that its securities lending business had been losing money at a rapid clip for the past 2 weeks. As the J.P. Morgan bankers dug deeper, they found that AIG had been engaged in a dubious practice. They had been issuing long-term mortgages and financing them with short-term paper. As a result, every time the underlying asset, the mortgages, lost value, which had happened every day of the previous week, they needed to pony up more promissory notes. This is unbelievable. Mark Feldman, one of the J.P. Morgan bankers, said as he stormed out of the room in search of Brian Schreiber of AIG. When he finally tracked Schreiber down, he told him, We need you to sign the engagement letter. This is getting ridiculous. We've been here all weekend. Diamond and Steve Black had ordered Feldman to get the engagement letter signed or leave and take everyone with him. After all, as Black reminded him, J.P. Morgan had no indemnification if they didn't have a signed engagement letter, leaving them with exposure to lawsuits. And perhaps more important, they wanted to make sure they got paid for their time and efforts. Black told him to blame his boss in the event of any complaints. Schreiber, who'd been given signing authority by Willemstad, was nevertheless annoyed. His unit at AIG had taken to calling the junior J.P. Morgan team the Hitler Youth. But how could Feldman actually pressure him to sign such a document at a time like this? The entire firm was teetering, and his banker was asking for his fee? At first, Schreiber tried to suggest that the firm's counsel might have to be responsible for any signature, but Feldman was having none of it. Schreiber finally erupted, I can't sign this. My board won't sign this letter. This is disgusting. It's offensive. It's vulgar. I just can't justify signing this, he shouted. Feldman, who had called Schreiber a fucking imbecile to his face at least once, had now also reached his limit. If you don't sign this letter this minute, I'm going to have every fucking J.P. Morgan banker pack up and leave right this second. At that, Schreiber relented, and irately pulling out his pen, signed it. At 3 o'clock on Sunday morning, more than 200 bankers and lawyers from Bank of America and Merrill Lynch were on their second round of pizza delivery at Wachtell Lipton, and they were still sprinting to complete their diligence. Greg Fleming, who had been awake for almost 24 hours, had booked a room at the Mandarin Oriental so that he wouldn't have to drive back to Rye. He was gathering his belongings and about to call it a night when Peter Kelly, Merrill's deal lawyer, entered the conference room. I've got news, Fleming told him. He enthusiastically explained that he had already broached the issue of price with Curl and had reason to believe that Bank of America might be willing to pay as much as $30 a share. For a moment, Kelly thought Fleming had been joking. "I can't believe they're going to pay us $30," Kelly told him. "Greg, this trade is never going to happen. It doesn't make any sense. We're on our knees here." "I'm telling you," Fleming insisted. "I think they're going to get there." "You're getting gamed right now, and you don't know it," Kelly snapped, trying to talk some sense into his friend at this late hour. "You need to wake up and figure out how you're getting gamed, because there's no way they're doing a $30 trade. They're going to lead us to the altar, and they're going to renegotiate it at $3, or they're just going to let us go." "Don't doubt me, Pete," Fleming insisted. "The trade is going to happen." Chapter 15. At around 8 o'clock the next morning, Sunday, September 14th, Wall Street's groggy CEOs trudged back to the NY Fed. Lloyd Blankfein and Russell Horowitz, his chief of staff, each of whom had had roughly 4 hours of sleep, entered the building together. "I don't think I can take another day of this," Horowitz said wearily. Blankfein laughed. "You're getting out of a Mercedes to go to the New York Federal Reserve. You're not getting out of a Higgins boat on Omaha Beach. Keep things in perspective." Blankfein was making a not-so-subtle reference to John Whitehead, one of Goldman's former CEOs and a company patriarch, who had written a book titled A Life in Leadership, From D-Day to Ground Zero, which Blankfein had made required reading at the firm. A Fed staffer announced to all the CEOs that Paulson, Geithner, and Cox would soon be coming downstairs. When Jamie Dimon, dressed in tight blue jeans, black loafers, and a shirt showing off his muscles, wandered into the room, Colm Kelleher whispered to John Mack, "He's in pretty good shape for his age." Paulson and Geithner appeared and announced that they had good news, which everyone in the room already seemed to know. Overnight, Barclays had put together a proposal to buy Lehman and was prepared to move ahead. The only stumbling block that remained was getting all the other banks to contribute enough money, some $33 billion, to finance Lehman's bad bank. After instructing the group to finish working out all the details, Geithner abruptly left the room. A document titled Certain Deal Issues was now circulated, identifying some of the more difficult questions the bankers would have to consider. Would the two parts of a split-up Lehman each have enough funding after the deal closed? And could Lehman's bad bank be made bankruptcy remote, in other words, legally sealed off so that creditors couldn't go after the healthy part later? It was then that Dimon decided to play the role of John Pierpont Morgan, who helped rescue the nation following the Panic of 1907. "Okay, let's make this really simple," he announced. "How many of you would kick in $1 billion, I don't care what form it takes, to stop Lehman from going down?" It was the question on everyone's mind, but the one that no one had dared to ask. It was the same question that Herbert Allison, then of Merrill Lynch, had posed a decade earlier in the same building, when at stake was saving long-term capital management. Dimon, then at Citigroup, had had a seat at the table for that one, too. The only difference between then and now was that Allison had asked how many banks could put up $250 million. Even factoring in inflation, $1 billion a bank was a steep request. At the time, Jimmy Cain, Bear's chairman, had refused to take part. "What the fuck are you doing?" Merrill's CEO, David Kamansky, screamed at him. Cain shouted back, "When did we become partners?" Everyone in the room today was well aware of that famous exchange between two Wall Street kingpins. Blankfein told the room that while he wasn't convinced that Lehman actually posed a systemic risk, there was a larger issue of all the bank's reputations and public perception to consider. Bear Stearns did a lot of good things over the last decade, but the only thing they're remembered for is they didn't step up when the industry needed them to. What went unspoken, but was surely on the minds of many of the bankers in the room, was the role that Dick Fuld had played in the rescue of LTCM. When it came time for him to contribute his $250 million share, he explained that he couldn't afford to do so. Given the pressure on his firm, and the rumors then that Lehman was about to go out of business, he had contributed only $100 million. Now, with a dozen banks represented around the table, Dimon kicked off the fundraising effort. "I'm in," he said. One by one, the bankers began to indicate what they might be willing to ante up as well. When the tally was added up, they were close to saving Lehman, or so they thought. Peter Krause and Peter Kelly of Merrill Lynch arrived at Goldman Sachs headquarters just after 8 o'clock a.m., rode the elevator up to the 30th floor, strode through the glass doors, and slipped into the virtually empty executive suite on their own. Krause, having worked at Goldman for 22 years, knew his way around the place. Gary Cohn and David Vinier of Goldman greeted them and escorted them to a conference room. Before the meeting, Cohn had privately told Vinier that if Goldman were to buy a stake in Merrill, the price was going to be a lowball one. "I'm going to be low single digits," he asserted, a far cry from the $30 a share that Fleming had been hoping to get out of Bank of America. Cohn didn't say so at the time, but he was thinking the entire firm's value might be just several billion dollars. Merrill's market capitalization on Friday had been $26.1 billion. Krause brought with him the same deck or presentation that he had taken to Morgan Stanley. He told the Goldman bankers that Merrill was looking to sell a 9.9% stake in the firm and also looking for a $20 billion credit facility. Before the negotiating even began, Cohn, always blunt, told them, "I'm going to write down your mortgage portfolios to a place where I think they click." In other words, he was going to value Merrill's toxic assets at next to nothing. "I know the way you think," Krause replied. "You could put a positive number on it," he said, hoping that Cohn and Vinier would at least assign some value to the portfolio. Just as Krause began digging deeper into Merrill's balance sheet, Kelly, the only non-Goldman-connected man in the room, stopped him. He was clearly anxious about providing Goldman with too much information. Krause may have trusted his former colleagues, but Kelly was more circumspect. To him, the odds of pulling off a deal with Goldman were low, and given Cohn's comments, if a deal did come together, Merrill would be sold for a song. "Guys, nothing personal, but let's just lay low here," Kelly said. "If you want to do due diligence, let us talk to John and let's figure out what we want to do." That was acceptable to Cohn and Vinier, who in any case had to go back to the NY Fed. They agreed they'd resume the talks once Krause and Kelly could get their information in order. As the meeting was breaking up, Kelly called Fleming to give him a progress report. He said that he and Krause had made their pitch, but he acknowledged that simply getting a credit line in exchange for 9.9% might not be enough to save the firm. "That's not going to fill the gap if Lehman goes," he told Fleming. "It looks like we may have the outlines of a deal around the financing," Steve Shaffrin, a senior advisor at Treasury, announced to Bart McDade and the Lehman team at the NY Fed. Brandishing a huge smile, Shaffrin told the Lehman bankers that the CEOs downstairs were close to agreeing to funding the spin-off of Lehman's real estate assets. The men felt as if an unimaginable burden had been lifted almost instantaneously from them. And McDade excitedly tapped out a message on his BlackBerry to Michael Gelbin, who was at Simpson Thacker's offices. Standing in a conference room uptown, Gelbin read McDade's message and shouted. "We got it," he said, a broad grin spreading across his face as he let out a sigh of relief. Hector Sants, the deputy head of Britain's Financial Services Authority, was driving along the A30 from Cornwall on the southwestern tip of England back to London on Sunday afternoon, with his cell phone clutched precariously between his ear and his shoulder. Sants had been on the phone for most of the weekend with his boss, Sir Callum McCarthy, head of the FSA and a former Barclays banker himself. McCarthy, at 64 years old, had only 6 days remaining in his tenure in the post and was scheduled to step down that Friday. Sants and McCarthy had spent hours trying to assess the state of affairs between Barclays and Lehman. Sants had been in contact several times with Varley that day, but McCarthy's efforts to contact Geithner, his counterpart in the United States, were proving more difficult. They had spoken briefly on Saturday, but he had heard nothing since. "He hasn't called me back," McCarthy grumbled. "You can't get hold of any of these people." They had no idea what Barclays Diamond had or had not communicated to the U.S. government, about what conditions had to be met to receive their blessing back in Britain. Indeed, McCarthy was nervous that Diamond, an American who had never become part of Britain's gentleman's club, may have been a bit reckless in the negotiations, like any aggressive Wall Streeter. Both men were especially concerned that Diamond, in his zeal to sign a deal, might not have fully explained the requirements that the British regulators would ask for before approving it. To them, buying Lehman could put the bank and the British financial system as a whole in jeopardy. Varley, who was supportive of pursuing Lehman, but clearly less enthusiastic than Diamond, had assured Sants during a call on Friday that Barclays' board would only pursue the deal if it could receive adequate help from the U.S. government or another source. "I would not recommend a transaction to my board unless I'm satisfied both in terms of the quality of the assets we're purchasing and in respect to the funding positions," Varley had said. McCarthy and Sants also faced another looming problem, one that, in the grand scheme of things, may have seemed minor, but was nonetheless important at that very moment. The London Clearing House, which clears many of the derivative counterparty trades across Europe, was scheduled to do a software upgrade that weekend that would switch all its transactions to a newer system. They had instructed the London Clearing House on Saturday to hold off on proceeding with the upgrade until they knew more about the fate of Lehman and Barclays, but were now being badgered for a final answer, as dozens of technicians had been engaged to handle the switchover. "We shouldn't allow this to drag on," Sants said to McCarthy, hoping they could get an answer back to the London Clearing House. "We ought to try to contact Geithner and just make our position very clear." They scripted out what McCarthy would say. "We feel as the regulator, in the best interest of the global financial system, that it's important you understand. We hope Barclays has already made this clear to you. But in the event Barclays has not made this clear to you, that we need the appropriate funding assurances, both on the trading side and with regards to the asset issues, if we're going to allow this to go forward." McCarthy said he would try Geithner one last time. On the 13th floor of the NY Fed, Hilda Williams, Geithner's assistant, told him that Callum McCarthy was on the phone. Geithner finally took the call, explaining, brusque as ever, that he had been in back-to-back meetings trying to get a deal together for Lehman, and apologizing for not returning his call sooner. McCarthy stopped him, saying that he was very concerned that he didn't know anything about the deal being contemplated. He had a list of questions that he needed answered. The capital requirements, and in particular the transaction risk between the time of taking on the risk and the completion of the transaction, leaves a very big, open-ended exposure, McCarthy said, keying in on his biggest problems with the deal. He explained that the FSA still needed to determine whether Barclays was properly capitalized enough to take on the risk of buying Lehman. And, he said, even if it was, which he suggested was a possibility, Barclays still would need to find a way to guarantee Lehman's trades until the deal was completed. "I'm very doubtful Barclays can ever get to a position to fulfill the requirements, and it is far from clear that they will be able to do so," he said. Geithner had no idea that the FSA would take such an aggressive position, and asked McCarthy directly whether the authority was formally saying it wouldn't approve the deal. "It is completely impossible for us to take a view on whether these risks are risks that we would accept," McCarthy replied, "unless you bring a proposal forward." But, he added, since it was so late in the day, about 3:30 p.m. in London, the chances were remote they'd be able to come to a conclusion within the next several hours. McCarthy went on to present another problem. He said that Barclays could not guarantee Lehman's trading obligations without a shareholder vote, which was a UK listing requirement for all publicly traded firms in Britain. However, not only was there insufficient time for such a vote, but he said that he wasn't authorized to waive the vote requirement. Only the government could do that. Geithner explained that, based on his conversations with Barclays, he thought the British government had already indicated it would be supportive of the transaction. "I have no indication that that is the case at all," McCarthy said firmly, and then expressed anxiety, as Darling had to Paulson on Friday, about Barclays' own health and that of the rest of the market. "Look," Geithner said impatiently, "we're going to have to decide in the next half hour what we do. Time is running out." "Good luck," McCarthy said curtly. Geithner ended the call and rushed into Paulson's office, where the secretary and Chris Cox were speaking, and recounted the conversation. "I asked him if he was saying no," Geithner said, "and he kept saying that he wasn't saying no." But clearly, Geithner complained, that's exactly what he was saying. Paulson was beside himself. I can't believe this is happening now. After a brief discussion of strategy, Paulson ordered Cox, who was the only regulator in the room with legal authority over Lehman Brothers, to call McCarthy. Cox, Paulson thought to himself with a sense of annoyance, was supposed to have pre-wired these very regulatory issues. I don't want to be left here holding Herman, the Treasury Secretary said, glancing at his zipper in case the joke wasn't clear. Cox reached McCarthy on his cell phone in the living room of his two-story home in Blackheath, across the Thames River. After the FSA head patiently reiterated the problems that the Barclays deal faced, Cox suggested they could try to work around them, adding, "You seem to be very unsympathetic to this." "No," retorted McCarthy coldly. "I'm trying to establish the facts of life so that you understand them and approach this with some realism." "You're being very negative," Cox insisted. "Look, you should understand one of the great problems for us, at this end, is not actually being properly kept in the loop of what you're up to," McCarthy complained, growing increasingly agitated. "You must understand, we are hearing things late in the day," he said, ticking off a list of requirements that Barclays would need to meet. "We could have told you earlier which ones would run into problems and which ones wouldn't." 5 minutes later, Cox returned to Paulson and Geithner, notepad in hand, deathly pale. "They're not going to do it," he said. "This is a total reversal. They never said a word to us about this before." Tom Baxter, the NY Fed general counsel, who had just walked in, couldn't believe what he was hearing. "We've come this far, the money's on the table," he said in disbelief. "Didn't they know this when they took the plane over here?" "I'll call Darling," Paulson said. In Edinburgh, Scotland, Alistair Darling, Prime Minister Gordon Brown's Chancellor of the Exchequer, was preparing to head to London for the work week, as he did every Sunday. It was about 4 o'clock p.m. local time, and Darling had been on the phone for much of the day with John Varley of Barclays, officials at the FSA, and Prime Minister Brown himself, trying to decide whether the UK government should approve the deal with Barclays. Darling had deep misgivings about the transaction, especially after he had learned from one of his staffers that Bank of America had dropped out of the bidding. Was Barclays going to be left buying leftovers? He had read all the coverage of the deal in the papers that morning, including an editorial in the Sunday Telegraph. Free things can still make expensive purchases. Investors should only get behind Diamond if he can prove two things: that he is retaining the kind of discipline that has been sadly lacking from the world's leading banks in recent times, and that Lehman, as transparently as it is possible to prove, is a genuine bargain. Darling thought it was impossible that Barclays could have done a deep enough examination of Lehman's books to be satisfied that the bank wouldn't be exposed to extreme markdowns of Lehman's assets in the future. Even worse, Darling had other problems on his mind. HBOS, the United Kingdom's biggest mortgage bank, was struggling. He also knew that Lloyds was interested in buying them. Between Barclays, Lloyds, and HBOS, the entire British banking system, he thought, was at risk. As all these concerns ran through his mind, he answered the phone call from Hank Paulson. "Alistair," Paulson said gravely, "we've just had a distressing conversation with the FSA." Darling explained that he understood that they had been in touch and that there seemed to be numerous unanswered questions. "I have no objection in principle to the deal," Darling said, "but you're asking the government to take on a huge risk. We need to be sure what it is that we are taking on and what the U.S. government is willing to do. The questions we are asking are not unreasonable." "We're at the end of the line here," Paulson said, surprised at Darling's position, and pressing him again about whether he was prepared to lift the requirement for a shareholder vote. "If this were to go ahead, you know, what would the U.S. government be doing? What are you offering?" Darling asked in return. Paulson reiterated that he was hoping the private consortium was coming together, but now Darling shifted the conversation and began peppering Paulson with questions about the United States' contingency plans for Lehman's bankruptcy. "Well, if Lehman is going into administration, we need to know, because it will have implications over here," Darling said before ending the call. "He's not going to do it," Paulson told Geithner in amazement. He said he didn't want to import our cancer. For the next 2 minutes in Geithner's office, a half-dozen excited voices were speaking at once, until he finally quieted the group and asked, raising his voice for the first time the entire weekend, "Why didn't we know this earlier? This is fucking crazy!" Paulson began to wonder aloud if President Bush should call Gordon Brown personally, but almost before finishing the question, he answered it himself. "There's no chance," he said, explaining that he thought that Darling had implied he had already spoken to Gordon Brown about the situation. He was so far away from wanting Barclays to do anything, he remarked of Darling. "Okay, let's go to Plan B," Geithner said after a moment's reflection. They agreed to assemble downstairs to relate the news to the bankers so that they could begin preparing for Lehman's bankruptcy. Plan B was simple. Regulators would press the banks to unwind trading positions they had with Lehman and with one another in a way that minimized the impact on the markets. "And then there was the next critical issue to address," Geithner said. "We have to deal with Merrill." As they got up to leave, Paulson, clearly depressed, remarked dryly, "If you're going to ride the pony, sometimes you have to step in this shit." A New York Federal Reserve security guard who had been searching for Bart McDade and Rajan Cohen eventually found them on the first floor. "Secretary Paulson would like to see you," he announced, before escorting them to Geithner's waiting room. Cohen was already uneasy, for while McDade had been sending out enthusiastic emails about the near consummation of the deal, Cohen had overheard a number of government officials who seemed to be more circumspect about its prospects. McDade now also sensed that something was amiss and sent a message to Gelband while he was waiting, telling him there might be a holdup. The door to Geithner's office opened and out walked Geithner, Paulson, and Cox, all looking alarmingly dour. "We got the banks to agree to fund, but the UK government has said no," Paulson announced. "Why? Who?" Cohen asked, incredulous. "It came from Downing Street. They don't want U.S. problems infecting the UK system," Paulson said. While McDade just stood mutely in shock, Cohen, who was famous for his equanimity, virtually shouted, "I cannot believe this! You have to do something!" "Look," Paulson said sternly, "I'm not going to cajole them, and I'm not going to threaten them." Cohen was not finished. "I know a lever we can pull with the UK government," Cohen offered. "I have a friend I can call." Paulson just stared at him, shaking his head. "You're wasting your time. The decision was made at the highest levels." Cohen walked to a corner and dialed Callum McCarthy directly. They had known each other for years. Cohen had been Barclays' lawyer in the 1990s when McCarthy worked there. But the look on Cohen's face as he explained the situation told the story unequivocally. McCarthy was clearly not able to help his friend. "You've really got this wrong if you don't think this is going to infect you," Cohen told McCarthy, nearly begging him to reverse his decision. "By not doing the deal, it's going to infect you." Downstairs, Paulson, Geithner, and Cox entered the main conference room, where the CEOs were still trying to coordinate funding Lehman's real estate assets. The mood in the room had been noticeably upbeat as they continued to make progress. "Those of you who do not want to assist a Barclays deal can breathe a sigh of relief," Paulson announced, somewhat awkwardly, and a number of bankers in the room did not understand what he was trying to convey until he formally announced that the deal was dead. "The British are not allowing for this type of guarantee. They can't get it done by tonight. They need a shareholder vote." "But we have the money," Jamie Dimon said. "Isn't this our closest ally in the world?" one of the bankers asked. "Guys, trust me," Paulson said. "I know how to be a tough guy. I've done everything I can. There is no deal." The general opinion in the room was that they had been blindsided. Paulson merely shook his head and declared that the British had grin-fucked us. Geithner steered the conversation to the necessity of setting up contingency plans. He said that Lehman's holding company would file for bankruptcy that day. He also indicated that the government would open up an emergency trading session in the afternoon for all of the biggest banks to unwind positions with the firm. Finally, Geithner broached the idea of creating a revolving credit facility which would effectively serve to help the next bank in trouble. The proposal was for a $100 billion emergency fund, with each bank in the room putting up $10 billion, $7 billion funded and $3 billion unfunded. Any one bank could withdraw up to $35 billion from it in the case of an emergency. At the end of the meeting, Paulson and Geithner pulled Thain aside and quietly told him, "We've got to talk to you." "John, you see where we are with Lehman Brothers," Paulson told Thain, once they had seated themselves in a conference room. "You've got to do something here. We don't have the authority it's going to take if you are looking for the government to save you." "I'm working on it," Thain said solemnly. "I'm trying to save myself." Thain explained that he was working on two parallel paths, one to sell a small stake in the firm to Goldman Sachs, and the other to sell the entire firm to Bank of America. He said that he had had coffee with Ken Lewis that morning, and that Bank of America was much farther along, but that he expected Goldman could move quickly too. Geithner had heard enough. He had to brief Bernanke, so he got up and left. Paulson could tell that Thain might be leaning toward the Goldman investment option. He knew Thain wanted to remain as CEO of Merrill, but instructed him to push forward on the deal with Bank of America. "John, you have to get this done," he urged. "If you don't find a buyer by this weekend, heaven help you and heaven help our country." "I understand it's not going through," Bart McDade told Bob Diamond when he reached him at his desk at Barclays headquarters. "What do you mean?" Diamond replied, completely taken aback. "I haven't heard that." "It's off. The government says it's not happening," McDade told him, and recounted Paulson's discussion with the British regulators. Diamond immediately got off the phone and called Tim Geithner's office. "I just heard," Diamond said, exasperated. "What happened?" "You should talk to Hank," Geithner told him. When he finally managed to reach Paulson, he said somewhat curtly, "I want to tell you that it was really difficult for me to get a call from someone else well after you did this." He paused, trying to keep his voice level. "And what I've been told you said is very much against what I think the facts are, and I think I deserve an explanation." When he hung up after hearing Paulson's account of the communications, Diamond was in turn deflated, furious, and embarrassed. He was livid with Paulson, and dismayed by the British government. How could they have led him so far, only to quash the plan at the last moment? At 12:23 p.m., Diamond tapped out a message on his BlackBerry to Bob Steele, who had been trying to set the deal up for 6 months. "Couldn't have gone more poorly. Very frustrating. Little England." Bart McDade, Alex Kirk, and Mark Shafir walked in silence through the underground garage at the NY Fed and piled into McDade's black Audi A8 to drive back to Lehman headquarters. For at least 5 minutes, nobody said a word as they all just tried to comprehend what had just happened. They had all come to accept that they were out of options. As they drove up the West Side Highway, McDade dialed Fold on the speakerphone. "Dick, you've got to sit down," he began. "I've bad news, horrible news, actually," he said. "Supposedly the FSA turned the deal down. It's not happening." "What do you mean, not happening?" Fold bellowed into the phone. "Paulson said it's over. The UK government won't allow Barclays to do the deal. Nobody's saving us." Fold, too, was speechless. Across town, Greg Fleming of Merrill Lynch and Greg Curl of Bank of America were getting closer to formulating their own agreement, as lawyers began to draft the outlines of a deal document. The combined company would be based in Charlotte, but would have a major presence in New York. The brokerage business would continue to use the iconic Merrill Lynch name and its familiar bull logo. Fleming was working through some of the details when he took a call from Peter Krause, who was on his way back to Goldman Sachs. He told Fleming that he needed part of the diligence team sent over to meet him there. "I'm not sending anybody anywhere," Fleming replied. "We've got a good deal in hand and we're going to finish it." Fleming was worried that Krause, who he felt had been unhelpful from the day he had arrived at Merrill just over a week earlier, was trying to undermine the agreement with Bank of America, and that he was more interested in a deal with his old pals at Goldman. Fleming was also concerned that if Bank of America officials discovered that Merrill was talking to Goldman, they would simply walk. We need as many options as we can get, Krauss told him. You're the president of the company, it's your call, but you're making a big mistake.
Well, it is my call, Fleming agreed, and I just made it.
John, we have to talk, said Dick Fuld, almost begging, when he reached John Mack on his cell phone at the New York Fed. There's a way to make a deal work. Let's set something up. Mack was